I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a look at the upcoming legislative session of the Indiana General Assembly through the lens of the business community. We're going to talk about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's legislative agenda. My guests should be well informed on the issue. Joining me will be Michael Huber, the Indy Chamber's president and CEO, and Mark Fisher, the Chamber's VP for Government Relations and Policy Development. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda, really looking at what the business community's priorities are for this upcoming session of the Indiana General Assembly. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Michael Huber, who is the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's president and CEO. Returning guest, Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, John.
And a first-timer, Mark Fisher, who is the Chamber's vice president for government relations and policy development. You've got to have a long business card there, Mark. Welcome
to
the program.
I made up my own title.
Well, probably ought to start, if there's a theme to what the Chamber's approach to this legislative session is going to be. Start with that. We probably also ought to walk people. Well, let's start with the theme first.
Sure. We're an organization of over 2,300 businesses across all industries, and 80% of those businesses are small businesses of 50 employees or less. And the agenda this year, it's interesting to me, as this came together. We talk about it around the office. It's back to basics, or focus, or a real focus on the fundamentals. And it reflects a few demographic shifts and things that are happening all around the country, but particularly in Indiana. So there are a lot of people like me who grew up in a rural area who now live in a major metro area. And there's been a whole nationwide movement, at least 30 years, of jobs and population moving to cities. And so we've been a beneficiary of that in central Indiana. If you look at Indianapolis as a 9-county region generally, our population is increasing, and it's increasing by a lot of people who are moving as the jobs move from rural areas. But also we get people from the coasts and from internationally. So the key is we're looking at tools where we can continue to build upon that growth and strengthen the entire region, but the core city of Indianapolis, which is very challenged for reasons that we'll go into. And it actually, we're a business association, but the agenda actually doesn't reflect a lot of issues of tax and regulation. You'll find a few of those. It really reflects a concern among our members, among our businesses, that we need to adapt. We need to make more investments in things like early childhood education, which is part of that underlying foundation, improve our mass transit system, and work on a regional water system to prevent any kind of water shortage and get our hands around the demand for water. And so maybe issues that haven't been as controversial as maybe a couple of the issues that we faced last year, but we need to keep our eye on that foundation, the kind of thing that builds quality of life in Indianapolis, so the kind of city where people want to live.
And presumably work and businesses want to invest, right?
Exactly. I mean, the biggest thing, and Mark knows a lot more about this in more detail than I do, but the biggest change happening in economic development and in business is We are becoming a really highly, highly differentiated economy. And the biggest difference between a thriving metro area, if you're talking about the nine counties, Indianapolis being a metro area, the biggest difference between a thriving metro area and between a declining city, declining metro area, is your ability to retain talented folks and attract new talent to your community and create the kind of community where people want to live. It is not you can't win just by being the cheapest, right? Just by being the most affordable.
Mark, I think that was your cue.
I think if you look at our agenda, we're taking a long-term approach, and I think sometimes that it's tough in a legislative arena where you have 2 and 4 year election cycles, but really getting legislators to think long-term about how demographic shifts are going to affect our state, how they're going to affect our state revenues, and how they're going to affect communities, both rural, urban, and suburban communities, and what type of state or city we want to be, what kind of quality of life do we want to be. We know that we cannot decouple workforce development from economic development. And understanding the role of cities and the quality of life that they provide that will attract that talent, will attract that workforce that will continue a sustained economic development efforts.
One of the biggest changes that comes out of the Regional Cities Initiative, which is number one on our agenda, and we want your listeners to know about it, and we also want policymakers to know about it, is got to give credit to the governor. He put in place this Regional Cities Initiative. It was a study of other areas around the country that are thriving and what are they doing right. And what we found is if you look at the state of Indiana, the future economic growth of Indiana is really centered around 7 or 8 or 9 metro nodes, Central Indiana being the biggest, but Northwest Indiana, suburban Chicago, suburban Louisville, suburban Cincinnati, cities like Columbus. So of course, Fort Wayne and Evansville, that's where the growth will occur. That's where the population growth will occur. And that's where our best chance is of growing our economy if we can really double down and understand what makes a metropolitan region work.
How tough a sell is that, though, with the state legislature? Because anyone who's covered politics or the state legislature here knows that at least the perception among many of the legislators is that all of the money flows into, you know, the fact that Indianapolis is both the state's largest city and the state capital. It flows into Indianapolis, and it's the rural communities that don't get their share. Now, I know a few years ago, the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute did a nonpartisan group did a pretty exhaustive study that demonstrated that, in fact, the opposite was true.
Sure.
But that's almost like one of those, I hesitate to use the urban folktale. It's probably more a rural folktale here. Mark?
Certainly, this is an emotional debate because it you're talking about a way of life that is being impacted by mechanization of farming, mechanization of manufacturing. So small towns are seeing a flight if their children are leaving or to go to college, get a college education. The likelihood that they return to that small town is pretty small. But we do know that that we have a great opportunity to really, especially from if they're coming from other parts of Indiana, to attract them to Central Indiana. The role we play is to try to take as much emotion out of it and really hit them with facts. You can't dispute what the Fiscal Policy Institute did. There are only 21 counties in the state that put more into the state coffers per capita than they receive back. Marion County, I think 6 of our 9 counties in Central Indiana are what we call donor counties. So we need to get that message across. Of course, it is an emotional debate, and we have to recognize that this is not a very easy or popular message for especially rural legislators to take back to their constituents.
The problem is, John, so I grew up in a small town of 3,500 people in southern Illinois. I've been in Indianapolis since 2001. That people in small towns see the changes that have been happening now for a couple of generations, and a lot of people think that when they see jobs and population moving to cities, that it's government policy that's doing that, and it's just not true. In fact, the Fiscal Policy Institute study that you cited shows that cities, at least in our state, cities really subsidize rural areas, and it's a hard reality to face, and it's gonna have a huge impact on our future as a state. For instance, the proportion of retirees to actual workers in rural America and in rural Indiana is going to be a big issue that we're going to have to wrestle with. But I agree with Mark. we have our work cut out for us in showing that the success of our cities is interrelated to the success of our small towns. As one state official said yesterday, you know, Austin, Texas's boom definitely benefits rural towns 50 miles out of Austin, outside of Austin, Texas. It's where you get your medical services more and more. It's where you get your shopping. You know, the identity of your favorite sports teams or colleges are tied to cities. So it's definitely an uphill climb, but we think, I mean, more and more we think because of the regional cities study, a lot of policymakers are starting to understand what these shifts mean.
We are talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda on No Limits today. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, that whole issue of in some ways it's not even just an issue of rural and metropolitan. Increasingly, it's rural, suburban.
Yep. Absolutely.
Urban.
That's right.
And one of the issues that the leadership in the Indiana General Assembly said it's determined to take up this year, the whole idea of the school funding formula, threatens to exacerbate all of those tensions because the funding formula, A, is an incredibly complicated thing. We've done a couple of shows in which we've talked about that. But, you know, unless there's more money poured into the pot and you're going to shift around, I'm probably going to mix my metaphors wildly here because I'm realizing this one doesn't work. I need to go to the pie. Unless you grow the pie there, someone has to get a smaller slice if you're going to grow someone else's slice, right, Mark?
I think that's what we're hearing from the legislative leadership is that education funding needs to be increased as a whole. Now, once you increase the base, you start looking at the complexity index. And mm-hmm. I think it's positive to hear that they don't want to just take the same size pie and divvy up the slice a little bit differently. But they are talking about increasing overall funding but then have the effort to, as they say, equalize and allow growing largely suburban school districts to capture more of the state revenue. And that's, you know, it's a big shift as well. When we cap property taxes, we increase our state sales tax. So the funding for the day-to-day operations of the school is largely the purview of the state now. It's almost completely the purview of the state now.
How concerned are you about where this debate could go?
I'm concerned about it because anytime you've got an issue that could pit suburban interests against urban interests or rural interests against urban interests.
Pretty much split your constituency right down.
Exactly, exactly. And we need to keep an eye on that. And I think so. We, of course, the Indianapolis region is made of, dozens of school districts, and Indianapolis alone has 11, right?
11 plus
schools,
charter schools.
Plus the charter schools, right? Now we're very involved with IPS at the center. At the center of Marion County, we're very supportive of the reforms this superintendent has brought about. We got involved in the school board race as well. There's no getting around that, but we don't want to see a situation in which there's some kind of zero sum reallocation or equalization of school funding. Our members in business do think it's important that factors like the economic need of kids and families are part of the formula. Things like special education are part of the formula. So we're going to keep an eye on it. I hope we don't have to adopt a defensive posture on that. I don't know, Mark.
Yeah, I think that legislators by and large understand that the complexities of educating children with different backgrounds, a lot of, you know, ESL, English as a second language. It's just how do they represent their constituencies as well?
We are talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Thanks for taking the call. A comment was made by one of the guests, and that comment being that it was not government policy to basically empty out rural America and cause an influx into the cities. And as a organic farmer for over 30 years now, I've seen it. I disagree with the statement. It seems to me it's been the policy of the government for quite some time to increase large farms and therefore help agribiz. and agribiz therefore creates stock for the stock market, and it gives control of the industry of the farming industry. And it used to be in this country, you know, you're talking about the small rural areas not doing as well. It used to be that, you know, you had 100 farmers with 100 acres, and each farmer needed a tractor, needed a truck, needed a combine, needed all that stuff that helped boost the economy. And now you've got agribiz, where you got one farmer farming 1,000 acres, and some of it's subsidized by the U.S. government, and they're even paid to not grow crops in some cases.
And Ron, I'm gonna
have to. What's happened to the economy?
Okay, thank you very much for the call. We're gonna have to take a break, but I'll get a response for you after we come back.
Thanks again for the call.
Well, we are talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's legislative agenda here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda. My guests are Michael Huber, who is the Indy Chamber's president and CEO, and Mark Fisher, who is the VP who sort of oversees policy and dealing with the legislators, right? Is that
correct?
A fair summary of your job? Just before we went to the break, we got a call from a listener named Ron, who said that took issue with some of the comments about how government policy hasn't driven people from rural areas to the cities, and said that, in fact, in his view, government policy had supported the development of large farms, and that had made the small traditional farm much more untenable. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, Ron raises some good points. Somebody who grew up in a farming community, I've seen those changes too with the consolidations and mechanizations of large farms. And I can understand his frustration in terms of government policy, I mean, particularly federal policy in allowing that to happen. If he were here, and, you know, I like a good debate. If he were here, though, what I would ask him to consider, though, is in the manufacturing sector, which really powered Indianapolis, especially post-World War II for at least three decades, there's been an equal or greater amount of job loss because of the automation within manufacturing, and also just the global economy and offshoring labor. But really many more jobs have been lost in manufacturing, you know, 10 times more jobs to automation than to, you know, offshoring of labor. And it's created a terrible problem in formerly thriving neighborhoods that were really based on, I mean, you've seen the, you know, the GM plant and the Ford plant and the Chrysler plant all in our city become shuttered, and the impact that has in their neighborhoods. And so I don't want to – I agree with some of his points, probably disagree with others, but I would ask people to also think about significant changes in the economy that have really changed the way that we live. So one more thing that I'll say is, and that's why in our legislative agenda, allowing cities to have more flexibility to utilize tools like TIF and like certified tech parks, these tools are not good or evil. They are simply tools, right? I mean, they can be used in ways that are helpful and ways that are harmful. We will always support communities having more tools at their disposal, especially as we try to figure out how we're going to make the post-property tax cap world work for cities.
Mark, do you have anything you want to? We've gotten a message from a listener named Gary via Facebook, and if you want to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Also can find us on Twitter at WFYI, send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org, or give us a call at 866-476-3881. Gary has said, I have been recently given a chance at an MBA graduate program and have invested in Indianapolis as a place to live. My last employment was with this state in 2009 and have had no other offers of employment. I did not receive retraining funds from the U.S. Department of Labor administered through INDWD, administered through Work One, because I had been trained beyond the college level of their programs. Indiana continues to indicate they are handling the economic downturn better. Question, where do I go to find any employment opportunity? Michael or Mark?
It's hard to know without knowing more about, you know, Gary's graduate degree.
Mm-hmm.
This is a problem that we hear more and more, though, actually. So, I mean, to say Indiana, we're handling the economic downturn and the slow recovery, we are, but there's some – so Mark mentioned workforce earlier, and workforce is one of those issues that keeps me up at night mm-hmm. as I look at our future. We are not – compared to other cities, we need to do a better job of taking workers, and I'm not just talking about four-year degree and graduate degree, but also workers with two-year technical degree, and better matching them up, do a better job of matching them up with industries that we know are growing. There have been a couple of local projects that were really important. One of them is called Hire Up Indy, H-I-R-E, Hire Up Indy, which has a supply report and a demand report, and it's got some really interesting information that shows us we still have to import medical technicians from out of market because we don't produce enough of them here. Mm-hmm. We still need to import aviation mechanics and aircraft mechanics from other markets where there are other types of degrees like four-year, you know, bachelor's degrees in liberal arts that we're really producing too many of. Now, that's not to say that folks can't be retrained and mm-hmm. can pick up new skills and go into a new discipline, but we're in a different world that is much more complex than what we saw, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And one thing we talk about in our legislative agenda, having employer-driven, sector-specific workforce policies by which our members, especially those in sectors that are growing, that are hiring mm-hmm. people, do a better job of putting, you know, positive pressure on academic institutions to strike to fill that gap. It is really complex, but we do empathize with Gary because it is a growing problem.
I think this we had on our legislative agenda this notion of career pathways. It's something that we heard when we traveled out of Nashville for our leadership exchange trip, which is their philosophy is don't just get a degree, become something. So I think we can do a much better job as a state, better informing people that are looking at college or looking at certification programs, that understanding what jobs are in high demand, what the earning potential is for those jobs, and what the pathway, the curriculum that you need to take to become proficient in that job. I think what the Higher Up study showed is, you know, we're producing too many general business degrees, we're producing too many marketing degrees, and not enough STEM type degrees.
And just so it doesn't sound like it's an attack on education, what we're seeing other cities pass us by, and we're very concerned mm-hmm. about is business needs to step up, and business needs to tell the story of these are the skills and the professions that we're going to need. And so we see that as part of our role to better organize businesses by certain sectors and tell that story.
How a lot of the conversation here has focused on workforce, on finding adequate supplies of labor. As you probably know, there are studies out there that show we by as early as 2030 we could be facing a worldwide labor shortage here. And that's going to mean that there's going to be a worldwide competition for skilled workers. There also is kind of a competing school of thought that the very nature of the economy and the distribution of wealth is going to change dramatically, that we're looking at the development of, rather than a middle-class economy where the biggest bulge was in the center, more of an hourglass economy where you have a lot of people at the high end, a lot of people at the bottom, and not a whole lot in the middle. How much of that is driving where you are? I know obviously the stand the chamber took on same-sex marriage was really about finding talented people to come to Indianapolis, less than the moral or social aspects. How much is this driving where you guys are right now?
So I've been in the job just 15 months. I've been able to attend a couple of roundtables with my counterparts in other cities. It's a Metro Chamber CEO roundtable. And one of the top two issues that was reported by my counterparts in other cities was this growing income inequality, growing, and which includes the skills gap that we're talking about, includes the growing poverty rate in many cities. And this is not going away anytime soon. And part of what Mark and I spend a lot of our time doing is sort of telling the story to business about the urgent need where we need to intervene, which is why the recent action by the City County Council and Lilly and the corporate community and United Way was so important to create that program. We, you know, didn't wait for the federal government, didn't wait for the state, but to get act with great urgency to make sure that our educational institutions, and it's, you know, cradle to career, it's not just pre-K, are adapting to the future. We could be in real trouble as a U.S. city because it's not just an Indiana problem. It's a U.S. city problem. But we do see things in Indiana that give us real concern, where we see our competitor cities around the country starting to make strides.
And it's not just high tech, high education attainment jobs. It's the middle skills jobs. You hear a lot about middle skills. I think we need to do a better job of destigmatizing certain jobs and helping people understand the earning potential, the lifestyle you get. The construction trades. I think I saw a stat that the average member of the construction trade in Indiana is 47 years old. The opportunity to go into a training program in the construction trades, to earn while you learn, to come out, if you're in the union program, you come out of their apprenticeship program with an associate's degree, and you're earning $70,000, $80,000 a year. But they're having trouble recruiting people because there's some form of stigma associated with being in a skilled labor trade.
And I've got to ask in this context, if we are going to be in a global competition for labor, both it sounds like both skilled and unskilled to some degree, what are the implications of the huge debate over immigration that we're having in this country right now? I mean, the fact that our governor is suing to try to overturn a presidential executive order. Is that helpful for business or not?
I can't comment because, Mark and I, and it's not an excuse, we don't make policy for the organization. We have councils and committees that we have made up of industry leaders that make policy. But there's no question. And number two, we don't do a lot of federal lobbying as a group. Mm-hmm. It's mostly focused on state and local. But there's no question that if you surveyed our members now, they would urge Congress and the president to get a deal done. Mm-hmm.
A comprehensive deal done.
We cannot kick this can down the road because the immigration supports really, really important sectors of our economy in the United States and in Indiana. And so our members take a very pragmatic view of what's going on.
I think Columbus, Indiana has the highest concentration of high skilled foreign born workers in the United States. So it's not just a big national issue, but it's close to home as well.
Well, and I should say it's not just a federal. I mean, we've had state legislators try to push through immigration.
Yeah, we're just happy to be here.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Michael via Facebook. And again, if you want to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Michael says, the Chamber of Commerce, along with their corporate partners at ALEC, consistently sponsor and pay for anti-worker laws to be passed, which harm many Hoosiers by limiting their income and widening wealth inequality. How do they expect to improve the quality of life for our fellow citizens when every part of their agenda aims to decrease the wages of workers?
Well, I would want to know which laws Michael is citing, because we've got, our partners, our partnerships with labor are pretty well documented. Now, some people think that the Indy Chamber supported right-to-work legislation.
That's where I was going to go. We probably ought to emphasize the difference between the state chamber and the Indianapolis chamber.
And this is so the state of Indiana Chamber are great partners with us. But like on your show, John, previously, they did not take a position, against HJR 3. We did. Mm-hmm. In the case of right-to-work legislation, we did not take a position on right-to-work legislation, and the state of Indiana Chamber decided it was important to support that. So, I would want to know if there's a particular law that Michael is citing that leads him to that conclusion.
Well, Michael, and if you want to clarify, I'm guessing from the tone of the message that he was talking about. About right to work, and that was more an Indy Chamber issue. You guys kind of set that fight.
I mean, here's where again, if Michael were sitting in the room, I think we would agree on some things. I don't pretend to know him from his post. Mm-hmm. One thing is certain, and this is not a comment on right to work specifically. We've seen enough that we know that if as a city of Indianapolis region, or if as a state, if we try to be the cheapest, if what we have to offer is we're the cheapest in affordability, we will lose, and we will lose likely to the southern states. The southern states and cities have so many more built-in advantages there. Now, if we position Indianapolis as a high-value player, mm-hmm. Where you can have a high quality of life, we have a cluster of pharmaceutical companies led by Lilly that other cities would kill for. We still have manufacturing as a very strong sector in our economy. If we position ourselves as a value player, we think we can win. Where we agree with some folks is we shouldn't position ourselves as the cheapest date.
We are talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Blake, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
I might be mistaking the Indy Chamber of Commerce and the Indiana Chamber of Commerce in my comment, but traditionally the Chamber of Commerce has supported conservative candidates while, you know, right now we're talking about things like early childhood education and public transportation and marriage equality, which are progressive topics. So, I mean, they kind of need to rectify that discrepancy between supporting conservative candidates while, you know, realizing that progressive ideas are the right ones. So I'd just like to hear some comments about that.
Okay, thanks very much for the call and the question, Blake.
I think if Blake saw our roster of candidates we supported in this past election, it wasn't. And I'll let Mark comment because Mark also oversees our political action committee. It was almost 50-50 in terms of Republican and Democrat.
Yeah, we really support candidates that are supporting of our issues, regardless of ideology, and that includes legislators that represent our 9-county area and outstate legislators. One of the things we hear a lot of is, you know, legislators don't like to vote on Indianapolis-specific issues, but because we don't have home rule, they must. So we need to be mindful that Indiana is, by and large, a conservative state, but we need to recognize when legislators go above and beyond and support issues. I will say that the state chamber has made early childhood education one of their top priorities.
Yeah.
But we have a different reality. We do concentrate on the 9-county area. About 50% of our legislators are Democrat, about 50% are Republican. And we have to work with both sides. I think many of the issues that we support are probably some of the only issues at the state house that probably need about an equal percentage of Republicans and Democrats to support. We are not pushing issues that we can get one party to get behind. We typically push issues that we need both parties to support.
And that, again, that reflects the growing, that reflects the changing nature of the 9 counties. And see, that's where we're different from the state chamber. Again, we partner with them on a lot of issues where we have common interests, but we've got a very specific focus on a more limited geographic area. It forces us to be pragmatic and it forces us to be consensus builders and work with both parties. And so, which basically makes Mark and me just really boring at cocktail parties.
So. Well, and I guess to differentiate, for example, the state chamber of commerce already has said that one of its top legislative priorities, if not the top one, is getting the state superintendent of public instruction position to be appointed rather than elected, in part because of the infighting going on back and forth. What is the Indianapolis chamber's position on that?
Sure. We too support the appointment of the superintendent of public instruction, but it's actually been on our legislative agenda since 2004 when we had a Democrat governor and a Republican superintendent of public instruction. So it's unfortunate the timing, unfortunate that politics has been injected into this debate, but we strongly feel that ultimately the citizens of Indiana hold the governor accountable for our educational attainment and our educational progress, and therefore, like he does with many other state agencies, need to appoint that position.
Well, the argument, though, that you hear on the other side, obviously, is, okay, you're saying that you want to introduce choice into the educational process and empower people. Why don't you let them actually choose who's going to be the education chief in the state? I mean, what's your response to that?
I think education plays into every aspect of what we do, from economic development to workforce development to family and social services agency. Education permeates everything in the state, and it's the largest line item in the state budget. And I'd ultimately say that what the legislature has said is they're the ultimate deciders on education policy in the state.
It has not prevented us from having a good dialogue with Superintendent Ritz. She came over and briefed our Education Workforce Council a few months ago. We had a good discussion. But my first question to her chief of staff, whom I've worked with before, was, does she realize that this has been our position since 2004 didn't prevent us from still having good dialogue?
We are talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Michael Huber and Mark Fisher, both from the Chamber. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda. My guests are Michael Huber, who is the Chamber's president and CEO, and Mark Fisher, who is the Chamber VP in charge of government relations and policy developments. So we've been talking a lot about really the idea of labor development. Probably ought to drill down here. Specifically, what kinds of legislative proposals do you want to see? What bills do you want to see become law? Mark?
Well, a lot has been done around the workforce development systems in Indiana with the Indiana Works Councils, the Indiana Career Council. The Career Councils come out with their strategic plan, and the Works Councils individually within regions are starting to unveil their plans as well. Definitely want to see much more focus on the employer-driven workforce development. So understanding the very specific skill sets that employers by region are going to be demanding now and in the future, and then how that affects curriculum. And that's where those career pathways come in. We have degree pathways that help to ensure somebody that can complete a college degree within 4 years. But we want to take that a step further and see really career pathways, which is if you want to become this is the curriculum, these are the specific skill sets that you need to become this, and here's the earning potential with those associated jobs. I think in Tennessee, they have the Tennessee Promise, they created 50 what they call promise pathways, which are career pathways, and very high demand, high skill, high wage jobs within their regions. I think we can look to the higher up study for at least the central Indiana region to understand where the skills alignment mismatch is and where we really need to focus our efforts, especially when it comes to the career and technical colleges.
Do you have a proposed bill already drafted?
We do not.
And someone to carry it?
We do not. We've been talking with legislators and the new commissioner of workforce development, Steve Braun.
I'd anticipate we will, by 2015. I mean, the skills, the gap between what the employers need and what our schools are producing is growing, but there's an information gap that's growing too. And so we'll support any policy to provide more support and money to really get at that information gap so that business, so our members and education can work together to try to fill it.
How much of this, we talk about the process of educating the public and to some degree educating even legislators. Is there a process by which you have to educate your members too? I mean, the perception to be fair here, the perception out there that the business community is all about just trying to drive taxes down as low as they can did not come out of thin air.
Right.
There is a history there.
So some of this, though, is not that new, and I suspect that's why we've been able to retain a lot of our members. We've lost some small members in recent years because of changes to basically federal changes in health insurance and this insurance product that we've offered. But we've managed to retain a tremendous amount of our members too. And I think that's because – so when was the Indy Chamber Water Study, 2009 and 10?
2010.
So we took on the region, looking at the region's water needs. Mark was a part of, long before I showed up, part of advocating for this regional mass transit system. So we, in a sense, it's reinforcing to our members that we've been headed down this road for a while on looking at these more quality of life, infrastructure type issues. But we are getting more and more into this arena, mainly because we're seeing that the world is changing really fast, and we're not seeing that in Indiana we're adapting fast enough. Our institutions aren't changing fast enough. Now, so far, our members have said, keep going. keep going. You know, we might lose a few here because of our stance on HJR3, might lose a few here from our stance on mass transit, but we've gained a lot of members too.
Is it frustrating, though, that, you know, to some degree, the political dialogue is still stuck where it was in the late 1970s or early 1980s, which is, you know, if you vote for a tax increase, you die. It's that simple. So the legislators are going to say, yeah, well, maybe the return on investment's great, but it's the person who's going to benefit from that's going to be the guy who beats me.
You know, I think it's really encouraging to see local government leaders and of both parties, Republican and Democrat, step up and really talk to the legislators about, you know, you've capped property taxes, something that many will argue was long-term beneficial, you know, provide stability. But at some point, you can't continue to cut and cut and cut. You can't cut to the point where cities and municipalities and local governments are unable to provide even the most basic services. So you're seeing this this banding together of cities and towns. Local chambers of commerce are really getting active because they understand how the quality of life does attract that resident, the quality of their schools, the quality of their streets, their parks. All of this plays into a community's ability to attract residents and continue to keep those residents. So I think you're seeing this groundswell from the local governments and local chambers up to the state level, and hopefully that does start to resonate with the legislators.
I've gotten an email from a regular listener named Jerry. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. He says, I was willing to let your guests get by with their business-friendly bias until one of them disrespected the humanities as a valid post-secondary educational objective. My college degree is in comparative literature, but I made my living as a systems analyst, nominally a technical field. I maintain that my humanities education made me a better, more productive systems analyst because I learned problem-solving and human relations skills that are woefully neglected by programs with a highly technical orientation. In fact, as a senior analyst, I was frequently the go-to guy when more junior, technically well-trained staff came up against problems that were not like any of the problems discussed in their technical courses. A liberal education with a big dose of the humanities is especially useful when thinking outside the box is required, because for people educated in that tradition, there is no big box, there is no box, and never has been a box.
So, first of all, I want to say, Jerry, sorry if I offended you, and I was not trying to disparage a liberal arts degree, and I'll let Mark say something. If anything, Jerry proves our point, because he got the liberal arts degree and then upgraded, but he went out and acquired skills where he knew he could get a job, and if he's here, in our local market. And so we don't have enough graduates of college that are doing what Jerry did in going out and getting his technical skills. And I'm sure that his humanities background has been a great compliment for his technical skills, but we just don't have enough Jerrys in our community, and we need to have more of a pipeline of people who graduate with, say, a liberal arts degree who can go acquire the technical skills.
And if Mark wants to weigh in, I'm going to ask him to be quick because we're getting a lot of listener questions here.
No, I'm good.
Okay, we've got an email question from a listener named Heather who says, what are the specific skills that employers cite as lacking in this skills gap that is growing?
So technical skills. So we have to import a lot of people. It's not just enough to be able to operate the machine. We hear from our members in manufacturing, people who understand how the hardware upgrades work or understand how the software upgrades work. That's number one. Number two, for students who are graduates who already have technical skills, we hear a lot of leadership and management type skills, because if you ask an employer, do you want a software developer or do you want a software developer who you can train and make multifunctional so that he or she can, you know, do a lot of different things? Because in the new economy, all of us wear a lot of different hats in our jobs.
I think a lot of this is very specifically quantified in the Higher Up study, and I think the website is higherupindy.org. I'd encourage the listener to get on the website and check out, because they do have that skills supply and skills demand. And what they did is they took any advertisement for jobs, any job postings, and in real time synthesized the data and the skills, the certifications that were necessary to fill those jobs. And then they looked at what jobs went unfilled. So we do have the data to show what jobs are in high demand that are going unfilled because we do not currently have that pipeline of talent.
We are talking about the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce's 2015 legislative agenda. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm wondering what the Chamber's position is regarding accountability and transparency for charter schools. So, obviously they would probably agree that transparency and accountability are important business leadership concepts. But getting metrics, or at least meaningful metrics, on charter school performance has been kind of tough because of the relative lack of transparency and accountability. And I'm wondering what the Chamber's position is on legislating or regulating that moving forward.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Scott.
Certainly, it does no long-term benefit to the charter school movement to lack transparency or to lack accountability in how they operate. We are looking at, especially when a charter school gets their charter revoked by their authorizer, how they go about shopping for a new authorizer, a new charter. We want to make sure that the public is fully aware of why they were why they had their charter revoked and what it would mean for them to get their charter back. Certainly, we want to see, and I think has been the argument all along, that charter schools do need to be held as accountable as traditional public schools. So in the long term, I don't think anybody in the charter school community would say that they want to be not held accountable, because it does a great disservice in the long run to the charter school movement
and the kids. I mean, we work with IPS, we work with charter schools. That's one thing about a chamber of commerce and a wide network of businesses. We work with everybody, but it also doesn't do the community any good to have overzealous authorizers authorizing schools and not holding them accountable. So we get it. It's not fair to kids, and I completely agree with what Mark said.
We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named Michael, I think, coming back saying, the chamber reps claim that they invest equally in Republican and Democratic lawmakers is a total falsehood, and I'm disappointed that you let him get away with that lie. And for them to claim that they act differently from the state or national chamber of commerce agenda is disingenuous at best. First place, let's deal with the first point here. Is there a place, a place online that Michael can go and see which candidates the chamber endorsed and, in terms of if you provided financial support, where he can find out what the dollar amounts
are?
Sure.
Our political action committee files annual campaign finance reports. They can get online find out who exactly we gave money to and what amounts we gave money to. I think facts will show that what we are saying about supporting Republicans and Democrats. Of course, there could be issues where legislators on either side aren't supportive of us, and we're not going to support them. But clearly, we give both the Marion County Republican Party and the Marion County Democratic Party exact equal amounts. We believe in a strong two-party system because it is a competition of ideas. And if a legislator or a city county councilor supports our issues, regardless of their party, we're going to support them. And we're going to – so I would just encourage them to get online, look up our PAC filings, and the facts are what they are.
And is the PAC Indy Chamber –
Yes,
what's
it's the
business, name
business Advocacy Committee.
Business Advocacy Committee,
yep.
And they can probably find that, I would assume, through
Secretary
the
State's
office. Yes,
the Election Division.
Okay, so Michael will take a look at that, and if you still, if that is the case, call me back sometime, and you can hold my feet to the fire. And I promise, the next time we have these guys in here, I will do the same with them. But does that some of what's going on here, and what I'm picking up in a lot of these messages, is this thinking that the chambers at the local, state, and national level represent a kind of monolith. is that a perception problem that you run into? Obviously,
yeah.
And could you talk about,
yeah.
If there are places where the Indy Chamber differs with the state chamber on policy questions. Could you outline a couple of those?
Yeah, that is. I think it is a perception problem that we have to deal with. We're going through a lot of changes, and so a couple of areas. Well, you know, definitely we are not as focused right now on taxation as, say, maybe definitely not the U.S. chamber. I don't want to say the state chamber. We are focused at this moment with our agenda more on creating a better quality of life in Indianapolis. And, you know, it gives me, you know, when some of the real, you know, far right anti-tax people, you know, will go after me on the blogs and things like that, I get sort of a perverse, you know, satisfaction from that, because we're trying to tell a different story, saying we've got to improve the quality of life in Indianapolis. We're hearing from our members who are looking for good workers. We're trying to create the kind of city that people want to stay in when they graduate from, you know, high school or associate's degree or bachelor's degree, and that we can attract people to. And that is a very different focus from, let's say, maybe state chambers around the country and the U.S. chamber has been. Now, we do agree with them on a lot of issues because we're an organization of business.
We're also an economic development entity. So we have our local economic development corporation. We have the regional economic development marketing and business development arm. We have the entrepreneurship arm. So we hear from a wide array of businesses, large and small, from all different sectors, from all across our region. Businesses are not monolithic. We're also not, you know, just sitting up in an ivory tower. We're dealing with this day in, day out. We live in this community. I send my kids to Indianapolis Public Schools. We care deeply about this community, and so do the businesses. They're not just entities. They're made up of people who go to work every day and try to provide better lives for their families.
How much of this, though? It also sounds like, to some degree, what's going on, the fact that the state chamber has to represent many of the rural communities, and many of the issues we are talking about here do break down along that metropolitan and rural divide.
It's a nationwide problem, and that is the pitting of, I think you said it earlier, you know, urban, suburban, and rural interests sometimes against one another. And we see that actually, if you look at the nine counties of the Indianapolis region, we have all three types of development. And so, yeah, we're trying to be a unifying voice. That requires us to work with both political parties. Otherwise, we'd be marginalized and we wouldn't be an influencer. But there is a disturbing trend nationwide that you cite, John. And so part of our job, and maybe we're a little bit naive about this as we push this legislative agenda, is to try to show people in the small towns around Indiana that their fate and Indianapolis's fate, or their fate and their nearest major city's fate, are very much tied together.
Well, I think probably that's going to have to be the last word for this program. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Huber, who is the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce President and CEO, and Mark Fisher, Indy Chamber VP of Government Relations and Policy Development. I've enjoyed talking with both of you. It was a lively conversation. I learned some things. I'd like to invite all of our listeners to come back on Tuesday when we're going to be talking with Democratic candidate for mayor Joe Hogsett. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.